Chapter 13. The Reaction After the Educational Reformation. The most momentous event of the world's history, excepting alone the birth of the Redeemer, was the Reformation of the 16th century. Great religious movements have occurred before and since, but they are eclipsed by the brilliancy and far-reaching results of this one. More men have been reached, more lives revolutionized than by the combined forces of all changes in civil and domestic circles since that time. The fact is that when the causes of political changes in the modern world are considered, it must be acknowledged by every candid thinker that these changes are due in one way or another to the attitude assumed by the people concerned toward that one Reformation which was set in motion by the Wittenberg monk. Christ had been forgotten, and he came before the world again in the days of Luther. A few quotations from Ranke show how far the Reformation extended in the brief space of 40 years. And since we are dealing with the causes of this rapid spread, it is gratifying to see that this author gives, in the most natural way, due credit to the influence of the schools. Two things, then, should be noticed in reading these selections. First, the extent of territory covered by Protestant principles. Second, the part played by schools and teachers in the conversion of nations. It is about the year 1563. In the Scandinavian realms, they, the Protestants, had established themselves the more impregnably, because there, their introduction was coincident with the establishment of new dynasties and the remodeling of all political institutions. From the very first, they were hailed with joy, as though there was in their nature a primitive affinity to the national feelings. In the year 1552, the last representatives of Catholicism in Iceland succumbed. On the southern shores, too, of the Baltic, Lutheranism had achieved complete predominance, at least among the population of German tongue. In Poland, it was said, a Polish nobleman is not subject to the king. Is he to be so to the Pope? In Hungary, Ferdinand said, I could never force the Diet to any resolutions unfavorable to Protestantism. Protestantism not only reigned paramount in northern Germany, where it had originated, and in those districts of Upper Germany where it had always maintained itself, but its grasp had been extended much more widely in every direction. In Würzburg and Bamberg, by far the greater part of the nobility and the episcopal functionaries, the magistrates and the burghers of the towns, at least the majority of them, and the bulk of the rural population, had passed over to the reforming party. In Bavaria, the great majority of the nobility had adopted the Protestant doctrine, and a considerable portion of the towns was decidedly inclined to it. Far more than this, however, had been done in Austria. The nobility of that country studied in Wittenberg. All the colleges of the land were filled with Protestants. We are not surprised, therefore, to read that it was said to be ascertained that not more, perhaps, than the 30th part of the population remained Catholic. Step by step, a national constitution unfolded itself, formed upon the principles of Protestantism. In the Rorus and the Gastein, in St. Veit, Tamsweg, and Rodstadt, the inhabitants loudly demanded the sacramental cup, and this being refused, in order to compel them to remain Catholic, they ceased altogether to attend the sacrament. They withheld their children, too, from the Catholic schools. The Rhenish nobility had early embraced Protestantism. In all the towns there existed already a Protestant party. The inhabitants of Manise, too, did not hesitate to send their children to Protestant schools. In short, from west to east, and from north to south, throughout all Germany, Protestantism had unquestionably the preponderance. The Protestant notions extended their vivifying energies to the most remote and most forgotten corners of Europe. What an immense domain had they conquered within the space of 40 years! From Iceland to the Pyrenees, from Finland to the heights of the Italian Alps, even beyond the latter mountains, opinions analogous had once, as we are aware, prevailed. Protestantism embraced the whole range of the Latin Church. It had laid hold of a vast majority of the higher classes and of the minds that took part in public life. Whole nations clung to it with enthusiasm, and states had been remodeled by it. This is the more deserving of our wonder, inasmuch as Protestantism was by no means a mere antithesis, a negation of the papacy, or an emancipation from its rule. It was in the highest degree positive, a renovation of Christian notions and principles that sway human life even to the profoundest mysteries of the soul. Notice again that this was due to the educational ideas propagated by Protestants, and the reason why the papacy was so fast losing its foothold was because it had not yet learned that this Reformation, which began in schools and was carried forward by Christian schools, must be defeated in schools and by teachers. For 40 years, Protestants had the right of way in education, and the results were stupendous. Rank says, Protestant opinions had triumphed in the universities and educational establishments. Those old champions of Catholicism, the teachers, who had withstood Luther, were dead, or in advanced years. Young men capable of supplying their places had not yet arisen. 20 years had elapsed in Vienna since a single student of the university had taken priest's orders. Even in Ingolstadt, preeminently Catholic as it was, no competent candidates of the Faculty of Theology presented themselves to fill the places that had hitherto been always occupied by ecclesiastics. The city of Cologne founded an endowed school, but when all the arrangements for it had been made, it was found that the regent was a Protestant. Cardinal Otto Truchus established a new university in his city of Dillingen, with the express design of resisting the progress of Protestantism. The credit of this institution was maintained for some years by a few distinguished Spanish theologians, but as soon as these left it, not a single scholar could be found in all Germany to succeed to their places, and even these were likewise filled with Protestants. About this period, the teachers in Germany were all, almost without exception, Protestants. The whole body of the rising generation sat at their feet and imbibed a hatred of the Pope with the first rudiments of learning. Stress is not laid on their hatred of the Pope, but on the fact that the rising generation sat at the feet of Protestant teachers throughout Germany, that parents withheld their children from the papal school even though it might be necessary in so doing to send them from home to be educated. And finally, that the papacy was dying and Protestantism was spreading through the work of the schools. Would that those schools might have retained their pristine purity and simplicity. No power on earth could then have retarded the progress of Protestantism, and instead of only modifying the history of many countries, it would eventually have swept from the earth all forms of tyranny, both civil and religious, for it breathed the freedom of the gospel, and no oppression could stand before it. It is as impossible to withstand pure Christian education as it is to withstand Christ, whose power is its life and strength. It is with a pang that one is forced to trace in this movement that oft-repeated chapter in the history of mankind. As the leader of Israel was allowed to view the promised land from the top of Pisgah, but must there lay aside his armor and sleep the sleep of death because of a departure from right principles, So Protestantism, through its schools, looked across Jordan, but failed to maintain the principle of faith which could, at the crucial moment, command the waters to part. One reason for the decline is thus stated by Painter. In their efforts to give Christian doctrine a scientific form, that is, to formulate it, they lost its spirit. Losing its early freedom in life, Protestantism degenerated in a large measure into what has been called dead orthodoxy. Christian life counted for little, and the Protestant world broke up into opposing factions. Says Kurtz, who is disposed to apologize for this period as far as possible, like medieval scholasticism, in its concern for logic, theology almost lost vitality. Orthodoxy degenerated into orthodoxism, externally not only discerning essential diversities, but disregarding the broad basis of a common faith and running into odious and unrestrained controversy. Internally, holding to the form of a pure doctrine, but neglecting cordially to embrace it and to live consistently with it. How narrow the line between truth and error! How easy for those who had been given to eat of the tree of life to turn to the tree of knowledge of good and evil! What a pity that Protestant educators could not remain true to their trust! When on the eve of success, they turned to the old paths and called into existence a dialectic scholasticism which was in no way inferior to that of the most flourishing period of the Middle Ages. Papal principles are papal, whether advocated by Catholics or Protestants. Having left the fountain of the pure waters of faith, they turned to the only other accessible source of knowledge, the pagan world. That system of education introduced by Luther and Melanchthon, founded upon the Holy Scriptures, and through them viewing the sciences, mathematics, and literature, using the latter only as a means of illustrating God's Word, was replaced by the scholasticism of the Middle Ages. One involuntarily asks, "How many times, O Israel, wilt thou return into Egypt?" This decline is described in the following quotations taken from Painter, and they need no comment. During the period extending from the middle of the 16th to the beginning of the 18th century, three leading tendencies are apparent in education. These may be characterized as the theological, the humanistic, and the practical. A large share of the intellectual strength of the age was turned to theology. Every phase of religious truth, particularly in its doctrinal and speculative aspects, was brought under investigation. Theology was elevated to a science, and doctrinal systems were developed with logical precision and extended to trifling subtleties. In the figure of the Bible, they strained for gnats, meanwhile swallowing the camel. The life was thus lost in the pulpit and in the theological schools. It was, again, the teaching for doctrines, the commandments of men. Painter further says, "The schools, which stand in close relation to religion, were naturally influenced in a large measure by the theological tendencies of the age. Theological interests imposed upon the schools a narrow range of subjects, a mechanical method of instruction, and a cruel discipline. The principle of authority, exacting a blind submission of the pupil, prevailed in the schools of every grade. The young were regarded not as tender plants to be carefully nurtured and developed, but as untamed animals to be repressed or broken." Notice the creeping in of those very characteristics of papal education so often referred to heretofore. 1. Narrow range of subjects. 2. Mechanical instruction. Memory work devoid of understanding. 3. Arbitrary government as seen in the matter of discipline. To this we must add that which is the natural accompaniment in papal instruction, the teaching of Latin. Says Painter, quoting Ditz, in the higher institutions, and even in the wretched town schools, Latin was the Moloch to which countless minds fell an offering in return for the blessing granted to a few. A dead knowledge of words took the place of a living knowledge of things. Latin schoolbooks supplanted the book of nature, the book of life, the book of mankind. And in the popular schools, youthful minds were tortured over the spelling book and catechism. The method of teaching was almost everywhere, in the primary as well as in the higher schools, a mechanical and compulsory drill in unintelligible formulas. The pupils were obliged to learn, but they were not educated to see and hear, to think and prove, and were not led to a true independence and personal perfection. The teachers found their function in teaching the prescribed text, not in harmoniously developing the young human being according to the laws of nature, a process, moreover, that lay under the ban of ecclesiastical orthodoxy. That there was a cramming process followed, equal to any 20th century school, is evident. The discipline answered to the content and spirit of the instruction. The principle was to tame the pupils, not to educate them. They were to hold themselves motionless, that the school exercises might not be disturbed. What took place in their minds, and how their several characters were constituted, the school pedants did not understand and appreciate. In order to appreciate the rapidity with which the relapse took place from the educational system introduced by Luther to the medieval principles and methods, our attention is directed to the school of John Sturm. This man, regarded as the greatest educator that the Reformed Church produced during this period, died in 1589, less than 70 years after the Diet of Worms. Hence, his work fell within the half-century following those 40 years of unusual prosperity for Protestantism which has already been noticed. His work is contemporary with the first Jesuit school of Germany. The decline is visible in every feature of his work. John Sturm presided for 40 years over the Gymnasium of Strasbourg, and his boast was that his institution reproduced the best periods of Athens and Rome, and in fact, he succeeded in giving to his adopted city the name of New Athens. Sturm's school stood as a halfway mark between the Christian schools and the purely papal schools of the Jesuits. But since compromise always places a person or institution on the side of wrong, in weighing the worth of his school, the balances necessarily tip in favor of the papacy. That his was a mixture of the medieval classical literature with a thin slice of scripture sandwiched in for effect is seen in the course of study as outlined by Painter. The school was divided into 10 classes covering 10 years, but only so much is given as is necessary to show the character of the studies. 10th class, the alphabet, reading, writing, Latin declensions and conjugations, German or Latin catechism. 9th class, Latin declensions and conjugations continued, memorizing of Latin words. The 8th and the 7th classes are about the same. In the 6th, Greek is begun. The 5th class is as follows: study of words, versification, mythology, Cicero and Virgil's eclogues, Greek vocabulary, on Saturday and Sunday, one of Paul's epistles. The remaining 4 classes have much learning by heart, rhetoric, Paul's epistles, orations of Demosthenes, the Iliad of Odyssey, memorizing and recitation of the Epistle to the Romans, dialectics and rhetoric continued, Virgil, Horace, Homer, Thucydides, Sallust, weekly dramatic entertainments, and again a reading of Paul's epistles. Such a course of instruction was well fitted to bridge the gulf between the papacy and Protestantism. It was imbibing, perhaps unconsciously, the spirit of the new papal schools. History, mathematics, natural science, and the mother tongue are ignored. A great gap is left between the gymnasium and life, a gap that could not be filled even by the university. In aiming to reproduce Greece and Rome in the midst of modern Christian civilization, Sturm's scheme involves a vast anachronism. The Strasbourg Gymnasium at one time numbered several thousand pupils representing Denmark, Poland, Portugal, France, and England. Sturm's influence extended to England and thence to America. An English writer says, "No one who is acquainted with the education given at our principal classical schools, Eton, Winchester, and Westminster, 40 years ago, can fail to see that their curriculum was framed in a great degree on Sturm's model. And yet it is acknowledged that his scheme involves a vast anachronism. To show that Sturm is the father of much of the instruction now given in our high schools and universities, Rosencrantz says, "John Sturm of Strasbourg, long before Comenius, had laid the foundation of what has become the traditional course of instruction and methods of study in the classical schools for preparation for college." The decline in the matter of instruction was accompanied by a corresponding retrogression in the morals of university students. Painter tells us that the state of morals at the universities of the 16th and 17th centuries was very low. Idleness, drunkenness, disorder, and licentiousness prevailed in an unparalleled degree. The practice of hazing was universal, and new students were subjected to shocking indignities. Duke Albrecht of the University of Jena wrote in 1624, "Customs before unheard of, inexcusable, unreasonable, and wholly barbarian, have come into existence." Then he speaks of the insulting names, the expensive suppers, and the carousing of the students, until parents in distant places either determine not to send their children to this university or to take them away again. Protestantism lost much because she ceased to educate her children. Had Protestantism remained true to her first principles of education, her overthrow would have been impossible. She paved the way for her own fall by departing gradually from the gospel and by leaning more and more toward the classics and scholasticism. It was this decline on her own part, caused by the insidious workings of the Jesuits, which made possible the great victories of this order in later years. It was when Rome saw her youth slipping from her hands into the Protestant schools, and as a result, a few years later, found whole nations refusing obedience and building for themselves new forms of government, that, in her distress, she grasped the offer made by Loyola. And while the power he represented in its organization placed itself above the Pope, becoming as it were a papacy of the papacy, still she accepted his offer, and the counter-educational move began. The Jesuits organized to combat Reformation in educational lines. In speaking of the Jesuits, Painter says, "This order, established by Ignatius Loyola in 1534, found its special mission in combating the Reformation. As the most effective means of arresting the progress of Protestantism, it aimed at controlling education, particularly among the wealthy and the noble. In rivalry with the schools of Protestant countries, it developed an immense educational activity and earned for its schools a great reputation." Again, the same writer says, "More than any other agency, it stayed the progress of the Reformation, and it even succeeded in winning back territory already conquered by Protestantism. Although employing the pulpit and the confessional, it worked chiefly through its schools, of which it established and controlled large numbers. education in all Catholic countries gradually passed into its hands. In order to understand the reason for the success of the Jesuits as teachers, it is necessary to glance at the plan of studies prepared in 1588 from a draft made by Loyola himself. "Every member of the order," says Painter, "became a competent and practical teacher. He received a thorough course in the ancient classics, philosophy, and theology. During the progress of his later studies, he was required to teach. Jesuit schools contained two courses, the lower corresponding very closely to the work of Sturm. Rosencrantz gives an excellent description of the educational system of the Jesuits. He says, "In instruction, they developed so exact a mechanism that they gained the reputation of having model school regulations, and even Protestants sent their children to them. From the close of the 16th century to the present time, they have based their teaching upon the official plan of Jesuit education of Claudius of Aquaviva. Following that, they distinguish two courses of teaching, a higher and a lower. The lower included nothing but an external knowledge of the Latin language and some fortuitous knowledge of history of antiquities and of mythology. The memory was cultivated as a means of keeping down free activity of thought and clearness of judgment. The higher course comprehended dialectics, rhetoric, physics, and morals. Dialectics was expounded as the art of sophistry. In rhetoric, they favored the polemical and emphatic style of the African fathers of the church and their gorgeous phraseology. In physics, they followed Aristotle closely and especially encouraged reading of the books On Generation of Corruption and On the Heavens, on which they commented after their fashion. Finally, in morals, casuistic skepticism was their central point. They made much of rhetoric on account of their sermons, giving to it careful attention. They laid stress on declamation and introduced it into their showy public examinations through the performance of Latin school comedies, and thus amused the public, disposed them to approval, and at the same time quite innocently practiced the pupil in the art of assuming a feigned character. Diplomatic conduct was made necessary to the pupils of the Jesuits, as well by their strict military discipline as by their system of mutual distrust, espionage, and informing. Implicit obedience relieved the pupils from all responsibility as to the moral justification of their deeds. This exact following out of all commands and refraining from any criticism as to principles created a moral indifference, and from the necessity of having consideration for the peculiarities and caprices of the superior on whom all others were dependent, arose eye service. The coolness of mutual distrust sprang from the necessity which each felt of being on his guard against every other as a talebearer. The most deliberate hypocrisy and pleasure in intrigue merely for the sake of intrigue, this subtlest poison of moral corruption, were the result. Jesuitism had not only an interest in the material profit, which, when it had corrupted souls, fell to its share, but it also had an interest in the educative process of corruption. With absolute indifference as to the idea of morality, or the moral quality of the means used to attain its end, it rejoiced in the efficacy of secrecy and the accomplished and calculating understanding, and in deceiving the credulous by means of its graceful, seemingly scrupulous moral language. Here is a picture of this papacy of the papacy. Again, I say, had Protestantism remained true to principle, even this system could not have accomplished its overthrow. But since truth was neglected by Protestant schools, this system of the Jesuits easily carried every country into which it was introduced. The Jesuit system of education was intended to meet the active influence of Protestantism in education. It was remarkably successful, and for a century, following 1584, nearly all the foremost men of Christendom came from Jesuit schools. In 1710, they had 612 colleges, 157 normal schools, 24 universities, and an immense number of lower schools. These schools laid very great stress on emulation. Their experiments in this principle are so extensive and long-continued that they furnish a most valuable phase in the history of pedagogy in this respect alone. In the matter of supervision, they are also worthy of study. They had a fivefold system, each subordinate being obedient to his superior. Besides this, there was a complete system of espionage on the part of the teachers and pupil monitors. On the subject of emulation, as made use of in the schools of the Jesuits, Painter gives us these thoughts. The Jesuits made much of emulation, and in their eager desire to promote it, they adopted means that could not fail to excite jealousy and envy. Says the Plan of Studies, "He who knows how to excite emulation has found the most powerful auxiliary in his teaching. Let the teacher, then, highly appreciate this valuable aid, and let him study to make the wisest use of it. Emulation awakens and develops all the powers of man. In order to maintain emulation, it will be necessary that each pupil have a rival to control his conduct and criticize him. Also, magistrates, questors, censors, and decurions should be appointed among the students. Nothing will be held more honorable than to outstrip a fellow student, and nothing more dishonorable than to be outstripped. Prizes will be distributed to the best pupils with the greatest possible solemnity. Out of school, the place of honor will everywhere be given to the most distinguished pupils." As the Colossus of Rhodes stood astride the Greek waters, so the Jesuit schools spanned the gulf of education. One foot stood in Greece amidst its classics, for Aristotle furnished the leading textbooks, the other on Christian soil, having the form of godliness, but like the demigods of Greece, it was neither human nor divine. The results of the educational system of the Jesuits are well summed up in another paragraph from Painter. "The Jesuit system of education, based not upon a study of man, but upon the interests of the order, was necessarily narrow. It sought showy results with which to dazzle the world. A well-rounded development was nothing. The principle of authority, suppressing all freedom and independence of thought, prevailed from beginning to end. Religious pride and intolerance were fostered. While our baser feelings were highly stimulated, the nobler side of our nature was wholly neglected. Love of country, fidelity to friends, nobleness of character, enthusiasm for beautiful ideals, were insidiously suppressed. For the rest, we adopt the language of quick. The Jesuits did not aim at developing all the faculties of their pupils, but merely the receptive and reproductive faculties. When the young man had acquired a thorough mastery of the Latin language for all purposes, when he was well versed in the theological and philosophical opinions of his preceptors, when he was skillful in dispute and could make a brilliant display from the resources of a well-stored memory, he had reached the highest points to which the Jesuits sought to lead him. Originality and independence of mind, love of truth for its own sake, the power of reflecting and of forming correct judgments were not merely neglected, they were suppressed in the Jesuit system. But in what they attempted, they were eminently successful, and their success went a long way toward securing their popularity. One cannot condemn without reserve the Jesuitical system of education. For all false systems contain some points of truth, and the strength of all these systems lies in their close counterfeit of the true. Hence we can agree with these words, "Whatever its defects as a system of general education, it was admirably suited to Jesuit purposes, and in some particulars it embodied valuable principles." As the progress of the papacy through the Jesuitical schools is followed into one country and then another, one admires the constancy and self-sacrifice of those who have committed their lives to the order. Had Protestants been one half as diligent in advocating the principles of Christian education as the Jesuit teachers have been in counteracting the influence of the Reformation, far different results would today be seen in the world. In tracing the growth of the schools of the Jesuits, we begin with Germany, the heart of the Reform movement, and follow quite carefully the history as given by Ranke. Bishop Urban became acquainted with Leger and heard from him for the first time of the colleges the Jesuits had founded in several universities. Upon this, the bishop advised his imperial master, Ferdinand I, to found a similar college in Vienna, seeing how great was the decay of Catholic theology in Germany. Ferdinand warmly embraced the suggestion. In a letter, he wrote to Loyola on the subject. He declares his conviction that the only means to uphold the declining cause of Catholicism in Germany was to give the rising generation learned and pious Catholics for teachers. We can understand the grounds for this decision when we recall the statement that about 1563 it was said that 20 years had elapsed in Vienna since a single student of the university had taken priest's orders. The preliminaries, says Ranke, were easily arranged. In the year 1551, 13 Jesuits, among them Leger himself, arrived in Vienna and were in the first instance granted a dwelling, chapel, and pension by Ferdinand, until shortly after he incorporated them with the university and even assigned to them the visitation of it. Soon after this, they arose to consideration in Cologne, but for a time had little success. In 1556, the endowed school referred to before, governed by a Protestant regent, gave them an opportunity of gaining a firmer footing. For since there was a party in the city bent above all things on maintaining the Catholic character of the university, the advice given by the patrons of the Jesuits to hand over the establishment to that order met with attention. At the same time period, they also gained a firm footing in Ingolstadt. From these three metropolitan centers, the Jesuits now spread out in every direction. These schools were, some of them at least, training schools for Catholic teachers, for Ranke tells of a certain man in Hungary, Olahus by name, and dedicated in infancy to the Church, who, contemplating the general decay of Catholicism in Hungary, saw that the last hope left for it was that of maintaining its hold on the common people, who had not yet wholly lapsed from its rule. To this end, however, there lacked teachers of Catholic principles, and to form whom he founded a college of Jesuits at Tirnau in the year 1561. Two privy councillors of the Elector Daniel of Mainz conceived likewise that the admission of the Jesuits was the only means that promised a recovery of the University of Mainz. In spite of the opposition made by the canons and feudal proprietors, they founded a college of the order in Mainz and a preparatory school in Aschaffenburg. The Jesuits advanced up the Rhine. They particularly coveted a settlement at Spires, both because there were so many distinguished men assembled there over whom it would be of extraordinary moment to possess influence, and also in order to be placed near the Heidelberg University, which at that day enjoyed the highest repute for its Protestant professors. they gradually carried their point. It is interesting to note how they shadowed the Protestant schools, as if, like a parasite, to suck from them their life. In order to bring back his University of Dillingen to its original purpose, Cardinal Trutjes resolved to dismiss all the professors who still taught there and to commit the establishment entirely to the Jesuits. To show the rapidity with which the Jesuits worked, Ranke says, in the year 1551, they had not yet any fixed position in Germany. In 1556, they had extended over Bavaria and the Tyrol, Franconia and Swabia, a great part of Rhineland and Austria, and they had penetrated into Hungary, Bohemia, and Moravia. True to the purpose of the order, their labors were, above all, devoted to the universities. They were ambitious of rivaling the fame of those of the Protestants. The Jesuits displayed no less assiduity in the conduct of their Latin schools. It was one of the leading maxims of Linus that the lower grammatical classes should be supplied with good teachers, since first impressions exercise the greatest influence over the whole future life of the individual. The Jesuits were willing to devote a lifetime to one phase of education. It was found that young persons learned more under them in a half a year than with others in 2 years. Even Protestants called back their children from distant schools and put them under the care of the Jesuits. From this last sentence, two things are to be observed. Protestants had lost sight of the importance of education, and their schools had greatly deteriorated, else they would not have entrusted their children to the Jesuits. While the Jesuits began by working into the universities, schools for the poor, modes of instruction adapted for children, and catechizing followed. The instruction of the Jesuits was conveyed wholly in the spirit of that enthusiastic devotion which had, from the first, so peculiarly characterized their order. This had its effect, for earnest, wholehearted work on the part of the teacher, even though the methods may be wrong and material false, will surely react in the lives of the pupils. Viewing the work of Jesuit teachers, one feels to exclaim, "Since thou art so noble, I would thou wert on our side." And so, ere long the children who frequented the schools of the Jesuits in Vienna were distinguished for their resolute refusal to partake on fast days of forbidden meats which their parents ate. Teachers had more weight with the children than the parents themselves, and became leaders of the older members of the family, so that the feelings thus engendered in the schools were propagated throughout the mass of the population by preaching and confession. The final results in Germany, Ranke gives thus. They occupied the professors' chairs and found pupils who attached themselves to their doctrines. They conquered the Germans on their own soil, in their very home, and wrested from them a part of their native land. So much for Germany and its Jesuit schools. Concerning the capture of France by the Jesuits, it is not necessary to say much. Ranke gives a few strong paragraphs showing the work of the order as teachers. The Protestants of France made a great mistake and brought their cause into disrepute, especially in Paris, by taking up arms in a time of commotion. And Ranke says, "Backed by this state of public feeling, the Jesuits established themselves in France. They began there on a somewhat small scale, being constrained to content themselves with colleges thrown open to them by a few ecclesiastics. They encountered at first the most obstinate resistance in the great cities, especially in Paris, but they at last forced their way through all impediments and were admitted in the year 1564 to the privilege of teaching. Lyon had already received them. Whether it was the result of good fortune or of merit, they were enabled at once to produce some men of brilliant talents from amongst them. In Lyon, especially, the Huguenots were completely routed, their preachers exiled, their churches demolished, and their books burned. Whilst, on the other hand, a splendid college was erected for the Jesuits in 1567. They had also a distinguished professor, whose exposition of the Bible attracted crowds of charmed and attentive youth. From these chief towns they now spread over the kingdom in every direction. Through the influence gained as educators, 3,800 copies of Angier's Catechism were sold in the space of 8 years in Paris alone. France no longer leaned toward Protestantism. She had been regained by the Jesuit schools. Concerning the work in England, more is said, and our own connection with that kingdom adds weight in our eyes to the history of her education. Thomson says, "During the reign of Elizabeth, the papal authorities renewed their exertions to put a stop to Protestantism in England, and sent more Jesuits there for that purpose. What they could not accomplish through intrigue and civil policy, they were more sure to gain through the schools." Hence, Thomson says, "They accomplished one thing, which was to carry away with them several young English noblemen, to be educated by the Jesuits in Flanders, so as to fit them for treason against their own country, repeating in this the experiment Loyola had made in Germany. The Jesuits endeavored to become the educators of English youths as they had those of Germany. The Pope, therefore, established an English college at Rome to educate young Englishmen." Of this college, Rank tells us further, "William Allen first conceived the idea of uniting the young English Catholics who resided on the continent for the prosecution of their studies, and chiefly, through the support of Pope Gregory, he established a college for them in Douai. This, however, did not seem to the Pope to be adequate for the purpose in view. He wished to provide for those fugitives under his own eyes a more tranquil and less dangerous retreat than could be found in the disturbed Netherlands. Accordingly, he founded an English college in Rome and consigned it to the care of the Jesuits. No one was admitted into the college who did not pledge himself, on the completion of his studies, to return to England and to preach there the faith of the Roman Church." America was settled when the Jesuit power was at its height. Those teachers who penetrated Germany without fear and secretly stole into England when it was unsafe for them to be identified, followed closely the paths of discovery and settlement. "In the beginning of the 17th century we find," says Rank, "the stately fabric of the Catholic Church in South America fully reared. The Jesuits taught grammar and the liberal arts, and a theological seminary was connected with their college of San Ildefonso. All branches of theological study were taught in the universities of Mexico and Lima." In North America, their vigilance was no less marked. In 1611, Jesuit missionaries came over and labored with remarkable zeal and success in converting the Indians. In Maryland, a Catholic colony from the first, they held unbounded sway. Speaking of the time of Lord Baltimore, Thomson says, "At that time in England, the Papists were chiefly under the influence of the Jesuits, whose vigilance was too sleepless to permit the opportunity of planting their society in the New World to escape them. Their work has been quietly done from the very first, and some think that because of the papal decree of 1773, suppressing the order, they have ceased their work. This, however, is a mistake. For Gregory the 16th, whose pontificate commenced in 1831, was the first pope who seemed encouraged by the idea that the papacy would ultimately establish itself in the United States. His chief reliance, as the means of realizing this hope, was upon the Jesuits, upon whose entire devotion to the principles of absolutism he could confidently rely. But the Jesuits always accomplished their work largely by means of education. Hence, we may look for them to use the same tactics in our country that had proved so eminently successful to their cause in England and Germany. The chief thing with the Jesuits, as Gressinger writes, was to obtain the sole direction of education so that by getting the young into their hands, they could fashion them after their own pattern. It has been the avowed aim of the Jesuits to stamp out Protestantism, and with this, republicanism. In this country, where these two principles were preeminently conspicuous and so closely associated that whatsoever kills one kills the other, it is doubly true that by gaining control of the educational system, the order could work for the papacy the utter ruin of America, both from a religious and a civil standpoint. From the dawn of our history, there has been within our borders, mingling with our loyal citizens, a class of educators who carry out this principle described by Thompson. The Roman Catholic youth are forbidden by the papal system from accepting as true the principles of the Declaration of Independence or of the Constitution of the United States. Leo XIII, who was educated a Jesuit, remains true to his principles. His biographer says that the false education and anti-Christian training of the young which prevail in the United States and among the liberal and progressive peoples of the world must be done away with, abandoned, and Thomas Aquinas, a Catholic of the 13th century, must once more be enthroned as the angel of the schools. His methods and doctrines must be the light of all higher teaching, for his works are only revealed truth set before the human mind in its most scientific form. It is unnecessary to state the number of schools established by Catholics in the United States, which have been placed under the control of the Jesuits. Neither is it necessary to trace the attempts which have been made by the papacy at irregular periods in our history to obtain the control of our public school system. The affairs at Stillwater, Minnesota, and at Faribault in the same state, while unsuccessful, were weather vanes showing the direction of the wind, were posers to test the public pulse, and just so surely show the policy of the papacy in educational matters. Of far greater importance to us as Protestants is the fact that Jesuitical principles may and do prevail in our popular systems of education, and these principles, whether carried out by Jesuits or by the ordinary teacher who is unconscious of her situation and unmindful of the result of her methods, bring about the fall of Protestantism and republicanism. Our nation has repudiated her foundation principles. Are our Protestant churches doing likewise? The history of the educational institutions of the United States, which are discussed in the next chapters, will show how the plan of work now followed in our universities, colleges, and schools of lower grades are patterning after Sturm, and how they go farther back, connecting the 20th century with the scholasticism of the Middle Ages. It is without the slightest feelings of animosity toward the Jesuits or the papacy that these facts are traced. These both do for their cause what will best serve to upbuild it. Their methods, in so far as they accomplish their desired end, are to be commended, and their zeal is ever to be admired. The one problem for Protestants to solve is whether to accept Jesuitical papal education and thus become papal, forming an image to the beast, to use the language of the Apocalypse, or whether they will follow the principles of Christian education and remain true to the name Protestant. Let the reader forget the names, but let him remember that there are but two principles in the world when the standard of eternal truth is recognized. One exalts Christ and gives life everlasting. The other exalts man, and its life is for this world alone. Education, according to the second, does, in its methods, dwarf, enfeeble, and belittle. It puts stress upon the unimportant and passes by truth without a glance. It prepares the mind for absolutism both in government and religion. Education, according to the first, will be based upon methods which develop in every particular the human being. It is a mental, moral, and physical education, and its object is so to educate that eventually each of these three natures will assume the right relation to the other two. And again, as on the Mount of Transfiguration with the Son of God, divinity within will flash forth to meet divinity without.